You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Alexander Himon's stories are darkly ironic and often hilarious as they jump between Bosnia, his troubled home country, and America, where his characters don't experience opportunity as advertised. The New Yorker has called him an astonishing talent, magnificent and cunningly ambitious. His latest novel, The Lazarus Project, was named New York Magazine's Best Book of 2008, was a finalist for the National Book Award. And now he has a new collection of stories called Love and Obstacles. It's published by Riverhead Books. I'm very pleased it has brought Alexander Himon back to our show. Hi.
Hi. Nice to be here.
I was thinking about that phrase, cunningly ambitious. Is that anything like Cassius's lean and hungry look?
I don't know. It's not my phrase. I would not describe myself as cunning, though it sounds dangerous.
And what about ambitious?
ambitious. If you're Bosnian, ambitious is not one of the characteristics that we are proud of.
Bogdan, I wouldn't call ambitious, although so resentful of other people who have succeeded. He's the narrator of many of these stories, but he takes on varying forms. His friends introduce him as the conductor of an orchestra. We see him selling magazine subscriptions door-to-door in Chicago. He's a struggling poet. Is he all of those things, or are these many different Bogdans?
He is. Well, actually, Bogdan is not the name of the narrator. There's a character named Bogdan with whom he identifies. So there's that, too. I like people who are complicated, and one of the ways to convey that complicatedness is by offering various facets of their personality. Sometimes they are seemingly mutually exclusive.
Well, he can be annoying in some of these stories. He smokes, sometimes drinks to excess, takes drugs in some of the stories as well. And a lot of readers will be reminded of Dostoevsky's narrator in Notes from the Underground.
Well, that's an interesting connection. I don't think he's...
Because he's so full of anger at times.
There's that, but he also does have a sense of humor, which I guess compensates for that anger. But he is, in fact, full of energy that he does not quite know what to do with. And that energy sometimes expresses itself as anger and sometimes as sarcastic humor.
How would you compare him to Brick, the hero of the Lazarus Project?
I think Brick is sadder in some ways, and although Brick is also angry. And also Brick has a project, the Lazarus Project, which sort of focuses him, however misguided his focus might be, whereas this narrator, who doesn't really have a name, he is constantly looking for something. This search is... expressed in his writing ambition, and he never quite gets there.
Have you been writing these stories all along? Because a number of them have been published over the last few years in The New Yorker. Did you work on them while you were working on The Lazarus Project?
Right. I was writing them at the same time. I would take a break from The Lazarus Project and then write a story and get it published in The New Yorker and then go back to The Lazarus Project. I had not planned to do it that way, but I realized that actually it was very good for me. I really enjoyed it because I could leave Lazarus Project and not feel unproductive, but also I didn't have to put everything I was thinking about or was interested into the Lazarus Project.
That's what I was wondering about, because things will occur to you, and you have two choices. You either shoehorn them into the thing you're writing, or you say, okay, I'll just put that somewhere else. But do you see some kind of dialogue between the two?
They complement each other, these books, in my mind. There are things that are, they're not in... The Lazarus Project at all. For instance, Brick has no... He mentions his parents only once. And for whatever reason, the relationship between the narrator and his parents was interesting to me. And so I didn't have to cram that into The Lazarus Project.
But here you have parents in a number of stories.
Right, yeah. And there are other things,
annoying too. Parents.
Well, loving nevertheless, yes.
Your narrator describes the misery of living in America, and he despises Bush and his Jesus freaks, the word carbs, and what he calls the systematic extermination of joy from American life. Why is he so angry? Does this arise out of the alienation of the emigre experience?
I guess that's his experience. It's never quite described in the book why he's so angry, but it just comes through. Part of his anger is the projection of unfulfilled dreams. So the dreams that he might not have been able to fulfill wherever he was, but he partly blames America for that.
Well, obviously this is not autobiographical, or if it is, I have no idea what dreams America's denied you, because you've done very well.
I do hate the word carbs, though.
You hate the word carbs?
I do.
And I'm sure that some of your political ideas have also been expressed in these things.
But I take them out because I don't use, you know, the character to broadcast my political ideas. I have other venues and ways to express my political positions, including voting. This is a function of the character. It is his, you know, streamlined anger.
Do people sometimes confuse you? Often people will read an I in a story and assume that that's the writer speaking.
In fact, I'm vain enough to read, you know, online reviews of my books. And one of the Amazon reviewers, he essentially said, this is obviously memoir. And as a memoir, it doesn't work at all because it doesn't do what memoirs are supposed to do. And it's baffling to me. At the same time, I can see why people read it as autobiographical. But it's also baffling to me because when I look at the narrator, any of those characters, I don't see myself. Or rather, they owe me. Every character in the book is some facet of me, a processed experience.
But you did push the point a bit. In one of the stories, the narrator refers to a story that he has recently published in The New Yorker.
Well, there's a continuity, I hope. I like to establish continuity between the personal experience and, how should I put it, historical or collective experience. To write, it's to start from a personal experience, but then expand outwards, as it were. So in the process of writing, I become someone else and become everyone else in that regard. And so once the story is done, the book is done, it's not about me. If it is still about me, I have failed.
Any number of writers have told me that they thought that writing was like acting, in that you become the character that you're playing.
When I was in college, one of my teachers asked us to think about what Flaubert said, you know, Emma Bovary, that's me, c'est moi. And I had spent years figuring it out, and only recently did I realize what it meant, that he became Emma Bovary. That's the only way to write. Rather than project his autobiographical, you know, signals into Emma Bovary, he became her. And this is what's so exciting to me about writing. In fact, reading, in some ways, with great books, you become the characters.
Well, Emma Bovary is a troubled woman, and you have to wonder what was going on in Flaubert at that time. And I wonder about that when writers write about serial killers and people who have other major mental problems, or are so drunk as your character gets every so often.
There's a complexity in human beings that writers, or at least good writers, can exploit. You know, dig up things from your depths and then magnify them and exaggerate them. And this is not autobiographical, but it is personal. I'm not a drunk, but I know how drunkenness would work if I were.
My guest is Alexander Himann, whose latest book is a collection of short stories called Love and Obstacles, published by Riverhead. Have your feelings about America changed much since you arrived here in 1991?
Well, they went up and down. I did not enjoy, to put it very mildly, the 8 years of the Bush regime. It was very troubling to me.
Well, the killing stopped in Bosnia. Would you have ever considered moving back there?
No, because the killing stopped, but the war continued in other forms. But I'm in constant contact in various ways, including writing. I write in Bosnia, and write a column that is published twice a month. And so when I go there, people know my work very well. And I just came back, in fact, and both of my recent books were published at the same time there, and they were very well received. But I can, in some ways, Sarajevo is closer to Chicago than Chicago would be to Sarajevo.
Hmm.
It's strange to explain, but I can. It's easy for me to get there and stay in touch with Sarajevo from here, from the United States, than it would be if I were in Sarajevo. And I need both parts of my life.
So when you're writing about your childhood experiences, it's better to write them in Chicago where you have a certain amount of distance?
It's better to live in Chicago. And so there are, you know, advantages to living here, but also it's the distance. You're right. Although I wrote substantial parts of the Lazarus Project in Sarajevo in 2005. I stayed 6-7 weeks there and wrote 6 hours a day. and wrote a lot of it there. And I needed, and this I thought was because I needed a distance from Chicago. So then I spent time in Sarajevo writing.
Is there a large Bosnian community in Chicago?
There is a substantial Bosnian community in Chicago. Outside of St. Louis, it's the biggest one in North America.
But when we've talked about this in the past, and I don't want to go into it too much, but you began writing in English, not in Serbo-Croatian. That is a language of Bosnia, isn't it?
Well, it was before the war. Now it's Bosnian. I had been writing, but it was different in many ways, and I was different for a number of reasons. And once I found myself here in the early 90s, I realized I would have to write in English because I realized I would have to live here for a very long time, for the rest of my life, possibly. So the language of my experience would be English.
Well, I've always wondered about the special connection between Slavic languages and English, because we have Joseph Conrad, we have Vladimir Nabokov, you, and I'm sure there are a few others who have done exceedingly well in English, even though you grew up with the Slavic language.
Well, there are Russian writers who write in French, too, Andrei Makin. I think it's the migration that is the cause of it. Slavs have migrated a lot around the world. The Slavic languages are different from the English language in many ways, and it's sometimes very hard to adjust. There are no articles, for instance, in Slavic languages, and a lot of Slavic language speakers, they have a hard time.
They don't say the.
Right. And you have to develop a new organ, as it were, to do that. I still skip an article here and there.
What happens when your writing is translated into Bosnian? Do you participate? Do you do the translations?
I don't do the translation because that's actually the hardest way to do it, because the thought is the same in both languages, and sometimes it's hard to separate them. What has happened with the past, these two books, The Lazarus Project and 11 Obstacles, is there was a very good translator, and I was in close touch with her, and then I edited the manuscript. But it was really fine-tuning, just the rhythms of my speech.
Well, do you think that because you're bilingual, that the Bosnian actually affects the English? Are you ever translating? Or do you think it would add to a certain, maybe a little poetry to the English because you have these conflicting words in your head?
Well, I translate idioms for fun. My sister and I, we do that all the time, and sometimes it's very funny. But languages always import other languages. I was heartened by an anecdote I read about William Carlos Williams, who was interviewed by someone who asked him about a particular idiom he had used in one of his poems. I don't know what poem it was. And the interviewer asked him where he got that idiom, because it was unusual. And William Carlos Williams, arguably the greatest American poet of the 20th century, said, from our Polish mothers, which I understood to mean that, you know, they imported the idiom from Polish, the Polish language, and then it found home in, you know, American poetry. I'm aware of the differences in idioms, but for instance, it's a very simple example. In Bosnian and Serbian Croatian, idiomatically you say black wine for red wine, whereas here you say red wine, and I have consciously used black wine, and here it sounds like poetry, but in Bosnian it's just the commonest thing.
But it also gives us a clue as to how a Bosnian mind would work, or how a Bosnian would relate to something, because we are aware always that these people are not native-born Americans.
Well, yeah, but there's always an exchange in that situation. I used to teach English as a second language, and most of my students were Russian-speaking, and I would sometimes start a class by showing the map of the world on which all the countries that gave words to the English language were marked, and all the words that, not all the words, but many words that came into the English language from those countries. Anything from pogrom to sushi, but the whole world participated.
Pajamas,
that's right.
Alexander Himan is the author of the novel The Lazarus Project, which was a finalist for the National Book Award and the National Book Critics Award. Two collections of short stories before this latest one called Love and Obstacles, which is published by Riverhead Books. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.